Welcome, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. I know we've all been transitioning a little bit here, so I want to welcome you to this session, which is called Conflict in Congregational Life. And I would encourage any of you who are in the back, if you'd like to move forward, I think there's plenty of spots. Don't be deterred by the bottles of water, because I think they were just left there by previous people. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce myself. Michelle Snyder was here from the conference, and she offered to introduce me, but I'd already planned to do that, so I told her to go on and go about her her busy day. So welcome again to Conflict in Congregational Life. My name is Leanna Fuller. I teach pastoral care at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary over in the Highland Park area of Pittsburgh. I come to this work as a former pastor. I'm ordained in the UCC, and as a pastor who was part of a church that experienced a very divisive conflict. And it happened to be over human sexuality, but as many of you know, many of our churches are struggling with that. But my interest in conflict is really beyond just the content of conflict, but really what causes conflict, how does it happen, what sort of sustains it, what are good practices to address it. And so all of those questions were really rolling around in my mind as I watched my congregation sort of have this very contentious, difficult conflict with one another. And that's sort of what sent me back to graduate school to think about this topic more. And that's what my dissertation was about. So I've been thinking about this for a few years. I won't say how many years exactly, but a few. And so this is a subject that I've really been thinking about for some time, and I really like to talk with students at the seminary and other leaders in congregations, other ministry settings about this topic, because it's something I think is so important. And what I saw in my own congregation was that we didn't know very well how to deal with conflict. We dealt with it in very unhealthy, unhelpful ways. And so my passion is really around helping people understand this more and to think more about best practices for how to engage conflict, because it will happen in the life of any community. And actually, a community that doesn't have conflict probably isn't as healthy as you think it is, because it means that people are suppressing things. So that's sort of where I come from, my interest in the topic. I'm going to grab a couple of handouts and start them circulating. And as I do that, I'd like you to think about, just for a minute, when I say the word conflict, what comes to your mind? So just think about the things that come to mind when I say that word. And after I start these around, I will ask you to share some of your responses if you're willing. A few more. I'll start these back here. I'll save one of these for myself. There we go. So there are two handouts coming around. There's a cream-colored one that's sort of an outline of what I hope to do in our time together today, so you can kind of follow along with where I'm going. Those are for you to keep, so feel free to take notes on those if you would like. The white one is a handout that I'll be referring to a little bit later in the presentation, so just hold on to that, and I'll mention that when we get to that point. So as those are being passed around, would anybody be willing to share what came to your mind when you heard the word conflict? Yes?
Anger, resentment, and gossip.
Okay, anger, resentment, and gossip, yes.
Arguing.
Power struggles. Yes, sir. Power and authority. Yes, sir.
Ugly.
Fights. Anybody else got one you haven't heard?
Mistrust.
That's a good one.
Unhappiness.
Any others? Animosity.
Divisiveness.
I'm sorry?
Divisiveness.
Okay, does anyone notice a theme to these words? They're not really, they're not very positive words. They're very negative words. Most of us actually do not like conflict at all. Most of us would rather not engage in it if we could have the choice. But the fact of the matter is, as I said a minute ago, we don't have the choice. Conflict is something that is part of any relationship or any community if people are actually willing to get to know each other past a superficial level. This is one thing that we don't often think about, but the more intimate a relationship grows, the more likelihood there will be conflict. It's quite easy not to have conflict with somebody you don't know very well, because you just talk about nice things. And, you know, I mean, it's possible you might get in a debate over politics or something. But if you think about an intimate relationship, a friendship, a marriage, there's going to be conflict. And that's actually not necessarily a bad thing. So I want to just say to you three things that are sort of my hopes for our learning time together. And I'm a teacher by trade, so it's part of my job to always say right at the beginning, what are our learning outcomes? What is it we're shooting for today? So the first is to discard fantasies, and particularly the following fantasies. First, that there's a quick solution to conflict that will make everybody happy. There is not. I'm here to tell you that today. I hope that's not news to you. But it's true. There's no trick or help that I can give you in a short presentation that's just going to allow you to go back and solve everything that's happening in your relationships or in your communities. I know, I'm sorry to disappoint. The second fantasy I want us to let go of today is that managing conflict is about finding a quick way to get the other side or them to capitulate and agree with me or us. That's often the way we think about conflict. We think about it as persuasion, argumentation. Several of you said arguing, fighting, so forth. And the idea there is that I can convince you to change your mind and come to my side. Now, that's a model that's used in debating in particular kinds of settings. But my experience is that in congregations particularly, it does not work very well because people have deeply held values and beliefs, and arguing is probably not going to change those. So that's one fantasy I also want us to discard today. My second hope for us this morning is to find a different way of framing the issues or challenges we usually call conflict. So I want us to think about conflict in a different way than just simply contention or arguing or fighting. That is certainly one form conflict can take, but it doesn't have to. And then finally, I'd like us at the end to talk a little bit about specific techniques that we can use as alternatives to debating and arguing, because as I've said, debating and arguing many times is just not very effective. It doesn't usually get us where we want to go. So those are kind of our three goals that I have in mind for us today. There's a lot more we could do, but I think that's going to be plenty. So I'm going to start with the white handout that I passed out earlier. Does everyone have a copy of this? I think there should be more around because I brought lots, so there should be more floating around. Oh, you've got some. Okay, so raise your hand, please, if you don't have a handout. We'll start with this. And on the front side that has a color diagram, at the top, you'll see a little drawing here that has a red arrow and a yellow arrow across the side and the bottom. This is a grid called the Thomas Kilman grid, and it basically is kind of laying out different ways that people approach conflict. And this is a grid that comes from the social sciences. It's not necessarily a religious or theological model. But basically, you can see there on the red, the vertical axis is assertiveness, which is where I'm focused on my own needs, outcomes, agendas, so forth. On the yellow axis across the bottom is cooperativeness, where we focus on others' needs and on mutual relationships, on preserving relationship. So you can see that the different modes of conflict fall out at different points. The first one you can see there in the bottom corner on the left is avoiding. Now that's where we really don't want to push either our own agenda or others' agendas, but we're really just trying to withdraw from the situation and maintain neutrality. I think most congregations tend to fall in this place. We would rather not deal with things that are difficult because we worry, actually, that the relationships will suffer. That's what I saw in my own congregation, that people were very reticent to talk about things, but what happened was they repressed those things they actually thought. So when it finally did come to a head, it was very explosive. We'll get to that in just a second. At the top side of the red arrow, you can see is competing, competition. As you see there, it's where the concern for one's own agenda is higher and the concern for the relationship is lower. Okay, so that's where you get people really competing, trying to win-lose, power struggle. That was mentioned a couple of times a minute ago when you all were brainstorming. And the zero-sum orientation that's listed there, zero-sum means thinking about something as a fixed resource that only, you know, if you have this much power, I can only have this much. So it's like whatever you get, I lose. And so it's a very contentious way of thinking about relating. On the opposite corner from that is accommodating. That's where we're really trying to preserve the relationship and we may let go of what we actually want, our own principles. So that's where we sort of accede to the other party. We try to maintain harmony. Sometimes in church we call it peace. But what it actually is accommodation, where we're trying to not have too much conflict. So, okay, I'll give you what you want because I just don't want to fight about it. So that's kind of on the opposite edge of contending, which is what we're talking about, or competing, as we were talking about before. And then right there in the middle is compromising. Now, this is what we often think of as the solution to conflict, right? When we talk about marriages, well, it's all about compromise. And compromise means that we find the thing that is minimally acceptable to all parties, sort of like the lowest common denominator that we can all agree on, and we still preserve the relationship. So, for example, in mediation or arbitration processes, many times this is what people are trying to get to, is something that we can mutually agree on, and usually, frankly, both parties walk away unhappy because nobody got everything they wanted. Okay, so that's compromise. And that's what we usually think of as what we're aiming for. But as you see on the grid, there's actually a fifth possibility called collaborating. And this is where creativity happens in the midst of conflict. This is where we expand our range of possible options. We no longer think of it as you can get this much, I can get this much, we have to meet in the middle, but rather how do we work together to find something that is actually sort of out of the box, to use sort of a cliche phrase, but something that maybe we hadn't thought about before. And it feels more like a win-win, not that both sides are losing something they want, but rather both sides are walking away, or however many sides, with something that they want. And according to people who think and write about this a lot, the collaboration option is really the only one of these that adds value to the situation. Otherwise, it's still all within a framework of kind of zero sum, you know, what you get, I lose. But with collaboration, there's a way of thinking about it as we're working on this together and we're trying to find something that's really different. So all the other choices are really zero sum. Collaboration is the only one that adds value and is more creative. So the reason I present that is because, as I said, usually we think about the solution to conflict as compromise. But there's actually another way of thinking about it, which is collaboration. And one example I'll give you of this is a congregation I studied in my dissertation research. They were having to go down from three worship services to two, okay? And there were two traditional, one contemporary, and their board said, we need to have one traditional, one contemporary, so we're going to appoint this committee and you all figure out how to do it. Well, obviously, the most logical thing is just to get rid of the smallest one, right? Well, the early service, traditional, happened to be populated mostly with people who had been attending there 40 years or more. And so the pastors, I think, in that situation wisely saw that simply eliminating that service would be a bad idea, that many people would feel disenfranchised and unheard and unseen. And so what they decided to do was create this committee and work together on, okay, how are we going to solve this problem? Now, of course, as you can imagine, they started with trying to just figure out how can we cut one and do the least amount of damage. But what they ended up deciding after several months of sitting together and really hearing each other was the people who were involved in the contemporary service said, you know what, we're going to volunteer to move our service to the evening. And the other two services agreed to go to change their times and become a blended service of a sort. This was not what the board had asked them to do, actually. And the board was sort of like, wait a minute, we wanted them to be on Sunday morning. But this was a collaborative way of engaging this problem. If they had continued to think about it as, okay, each party, each of the three services, we have to fight for what we want and what our service means to us, and that's actually what they were doing in the beginning, they really didn't get anywhere. They got stuck. But when they started thinking, how can we work together to think creatively about this, they came up with a different solution. Now, interestingly, the evening service, the time didn't really work out, you know, and they had to go back and find a different solution again later. But to me, the important thing was they were willing to think in that creative, collaborative way and not be too bound to, you know, sort of a zero-sum way of thinking. So that's just a quick example of how collaboration can actually work in a congregational context. But it required a lot more time than simply sitting down in one meeting and saying, okay, we're going to cut this one service. And they had to be willing to invest that kind of time and energy with one another. So I want to say just a couple things about the difference between conflict and a contest. A contest is like a game or, you know, a sports event or something, and it has three helpful constraints: rules, time frames, and referees, right? So you watch a football game, there are rules in place. When the time runs out, whoever's got the most points wins, that's it, it's over. And referees, there are people on the field making judgments about whether or not rules are being followed or whether a ball's in play or whatever. The problem with conflicts in congregations is that usually we do not have any of these things in place, right? We don't have anyone, really, that's designated as the referee. Many times we don't even really have rules. But rules could be established for our congregations, and I'll talk about that just a bit later. But the problem with that is if we don't have these boundaries in place, if we don't have these structures, it can lead to splitting, which is what many of you talked about in your brainstorming, the very brief brainstorming we did earlier about divisiveness and sort of animosity and just splitting apart. That's what happens oftentimes in congregations. So I want to spend just a couple minutes thinking about this idea of splitting or conflict in groups and sort of what happens in you when you think about that. So I want you to think just for a second about this question. What happens or in you, or what do you experience individually when a group you're a part of gets caught up in an argument? So think about that just for a moment. Anybody willing to say what you experience when a group you're a part of gets caught up in an argument? However you want to define that. Okay, good. Knots in your stomach. I have to say, I was saying this to my spouse the other night. I've been thinking and talking about conflict for several years, and I still get the knot in my stomach. And I actually, you know, trying to say that conflict's not necessarily a bad thing, but when it happens around me, I still get that feeling. Anybody else? Yeah. Yes. So frustration, just feeling like this is not going anywhere. This is a waste of time. Like, what are we doing here? Yes. Okay, interesting. You find it energizing. Well, and that's actually a positive side of conflict that we'll talk about too, that conflict doesn't have to be negative, although as we saw from our opening exercise, many of us do think of it that way, but it doesn't have to be that way. It can actually be energizing. It can be transforming for a group. Yes?
It can also cause a lot of hurt.
Yes.
Throughout the entire, you know, people are hurt by different things, but mostly by relationships that seem to be
breaking. Right. Absolutely. Hurt and pain are often what happen. And, I mean, I think what we're hearing is it can be energizing, it can be very painful. The difference oftentimes is how the conflict is engaged, how it happens, how people talk to each other. I saw another hand here.
You used the word argue. Mm-hmm. That's the word that just kind of blows me apart. When you get into arguing, I guess you can have a conflict, but you still be rational. When you
sure.
Don't speak,
right. So the arguing piece, that definitely has a connotation of debating, kind of contending. Things are very tense. But as you're pointing out, conflict doesn't have to be that way. It can be actually an exchange of ideas that are just happen to be different. But it seems that many times people have difficulty thinking of it that way. We think of conflict as this really tense, tense thing. So what, from your observation, when you get caught up in a conflict in a group, whether you call it an argument or simply a conflict, what does the group experience? So you have all have named some feelings that you have, being energized or being afraid or being worried about being hurt or that pit in your stomach, but what does the group seem to experience? Yes, so that's what I was mentioning before, the splitting. Many times in groups, it seems very quick that people sort of split into two sides. That's what I saw in my own congregation, that just immediately we had two sides. Took no time at all. What else does the group experience? Yeah.
People start to take roles, like the consoler or the leader.
Yes, absolutely. So roles. Sometimes someone emerges as the spokesperson of a particular position. You've probably seen that. Some people don't say anything at all. They're sort of the silent bystanders. Some people are the diplomats that are saying, well, can't we just work this out? Can't we get along? So, yes, different people in the group take on different roles. Yes, sir.
Interestingly, though, there's a cohesiveness on either side. So there's a split, but then a reforming around one issue.
Absolutely. So there's a split oftentimes in the middle, or maybe even into three or more groups. But within those groups, there's high cohesiveness. And actually, if you read resources in social psychology, they will tell you the same thing, that within the group, there's a high feeling of we're all alike, but this group is really different from that group. That's what happens. And that's part of the problem is in congregations, theoretically, we're all supposed to be part of one group, right? One congregation, and even more broadly, one body of Christ. But yet, very quickly, those divisions happen, and then all of a sudden, it's like, well, we're the same, but this group over here is really different, and we can't understand each other. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. That's excellent. So there was an awareness there that things are getting to a point where maybe we need to take a pause, remember why we're here, how we're united, and so forth. Now, I wouldn't want to suggest, using prayer as a way to avoid engaging in things that are difficult, because sometimes people do that too. But that doesn't sound like what you're describing. It sounds like it was more of an awareness that we need to take a moment to recenter ourselves. I think that's a terrific idea. Any other thoughts about what the group experiences when we get in these situations?
Yeah, the more worked up the leader is, it just tends to get the wheel spinning faster and faster.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So this is perfect segue to what I was going to say next, which is you're describing is a process of anxiety, okay? And what I have observed and the research I've done on this topic suggests that what very often happens when conflict emerges in a group, whether it is a tense argument or even sometimes when it's simply people disagreeing, but they're still kind of calm about it, many, many people get anxious in the presence of conflict, myself included. I was saying, I still get the knot in my stomach when this happens. And another way to think about anxiety is just a sense of emotional intensity. Some people just feel kind of sort of tight and just ill at ease, okay? You may have had the experience of walking into a meeting where you knew that something sort of contentious was going to be discussed, and you can feel it. It's like in the air. So this sense of anxiety or dis-ease or emotional intensity is really, I think, a foundational part of what's going on in conflict. And in my work, I use family systems theory as a tool to help me think about this, to understand how processes of emotional intensity work. I can see by nods that many of you are familiar with family systems theory, but some of you may not be. But basically, family systems theory is just a way of thinking about process in groups that tries to get away from seeing problems as sort of focused on an individual, and rather what's going on in the whole group or system. So rather than saying, well, gosh, that person's a jerk, and if we could just get rid of him, all our problems would be solved. What happens if you do that? If that person leaves?
New jerk.
Somebody else becomes the jerk. Or the congregation gets really focused on something else that's very anxiety-producing. It usually doesn't change the actual process of what's going on. It's just that one person is sort of helping live out the anxiety that the group is feeling, okay? But family systems theory does tend to talk about this feeling of emotional intensity or sort of being ill at ease as anxiety. And so if we can think a little bit about what is anxiety, one way that I find helpful to explain it that's in the literature is the sense of threat that people experience. It's like, how safe do I feel versus how threatened do I feel? And when people feel more threatened, their anxiety goes up. So it's really not hard to imagine why in congregations where we're talking very often about theology, beliefs, commitments, values, things that are very deeply held to people, anxiety rises when we find differences among those things or when we have disagreements about those things. anxiety is going to go up because they are very closely related to our sense of who we are, our identity. So what I saw in my congregation was, as I said, we had a pretty intense conflict over human sexuality. What I observed was people saying to themselves, wait a minute, I think this, you think that. How can we be part of the same congregation if we disagree on that thing that is really, really important to both of us? And people found it very difficult to sort of sort through how that could be, and they felt very threatened. And it resulted, unfortunately, in our case, in real emotional volatility in the moment, okay? So in the conflict, people were very, what I would describe as reactive, very just kind of, you know, not calm. They were very emotionally wrought up. And many times when people are in that state, they don't think real clearly about how they're talking to each other or what the effect may be. So back to your point about pain and hurt, people are not really thinking about that. They're thinking about making their point and saying how important this is to them, and a lot of damage can be done in the process. But it's important to realize that anxiety is different from fear. Fear is a reaction to the known, okay? If you're being chased by a bear, you should have fear. I mean, that's normal. You know, you know what's chasing you, and you should be afraid. And being afraid is actually a good thing because it helps you get safe. You know, it's a signal to your body you need to get out of there. Anxiety is a little bit different. Anxiety is not as tangible. It's kind of a general fear of something out there or something that might happen, but we can't quite put our finger on it, and that means we lack control over it. And that is very bothersome to most people, to have that generalized sense of dis-ease, of being sort of worried and tense about something, but we don't know exactly what. I mean, in a situation of conflict, we may have a vague sense that, you know, our congregation could break up over this, or our relationships could be damaged, but it's still a very diffuse thing. We're not exactly sure what we're afraid of. And in a system, anxiety can work like a chain reaction. You've probably seen this, as you were just saying, particularly if the leader is very anxious and is projecting that to everybody, everybody else gets infected. It's like a virus. Everybody catches it. And so all of a sudden, you've got a group that's just highly anxious and is having a really hard time relating to each other. So the thing that's interesting about that is that anxiety is a reaction to a perceived threat. Like I said, we don't quite know what it is. It's just sort of out there. But then once the group gets anxious, that in itself is also a threat because now it's like, oh, I'm in the midst of this really anxious group and I don't know what to do. And so that creates even more anxiety. And so it's like a vicious cycle and it seems hard to get out of it. And I would suggest to you, and the family systems literature says this too, that how well or poorly any system, whether it's a church or any other group, how well or poorly it functions is related to how well or poorly that system handles anxiety. So in a group that can hold anxiety and not feel like we have to get torn apart by it, we can usually deal better with conflict and difference, and we can generally be more healthy. For systems that are highly anxious, where the littlest thing causes a huge reaction, that's probably not going to be a very healthy situation because people feel like, you know, this is just a tinderbox waiting to ignite. And you can feel that, right? Like I was saying, you can walk in a room sometimes and feel it. So I want to kind of go back here and summarize a bit about what we said earlier about reframing conflict, moving from competition, like we talked about on the grid, to creative collaboration. The reason I think it's so important to move from a sort of zero-sum, fixed-pie way of thinking to a more creative or collaborative way of thinking about conflict is because when the level of anxiety, as we've been talking about, or emotional intensity is high, conflicts are instinctively seen as us versus them, good versus bad, right versus wrong, faithful versus unfaithful. It's what we talked about earlier in terms of splitting. It very quickly, when the system is anxious, we go very quickly to those polarities of just splitting into groups that are seen as sort of dualistic and there's no space in the middle. The problem with that is that this way of looking at conflict as being about us versus them and so forth is that really there's only three possible outcomes for that. Win, lose, or leave in a church, or maintain the feud. That's really the only options. My side can win, my side can lose, or we can keep it going, you know? And really, in all three cases, the whole group loses if that happens. That's what I saw in my own congregation. It was a very divisive conflict. People took sides immediately. We had a vote, which I do not recommend. And the people who lost the vote left because they felt they had no other way of staying in a place where they had so clearly separated themselves from others. And I think, frankly, they couldn't save face and stay for many of them. So the whole congregation lost, actually, because we lost 40% of our active membership from that. So, you know, the very next Sunday in the choir, there were just empty seats all in the choir loft. You could see where people had just disappeared as a result of this conflict. So that is not a good situation for anyone, because even the people who left, although they were no longer in our midst, they were in other places grieving deeply the loss of this family that they had had for so long. So one way that's helpful to think, I think, about what's happening in conflict is to think about it in terms of group concepts. We've been touching on this already in terms of anxiety and splitting. But first, the first thing we need to understand, and some of this is drawn from leadership resources, but also social psychology. First is that all groups form around a shared concern or need, similarities. I mean, part of the reason we join congregations is because we share a faith tradition, right? Or even if we don't come from that faith tradition, maybe we come from a different one, but we find something in that space that we connect with, okay? And we find people that we connect with. We find people that share our interests. So in the beginning, these groups form around a shared concern or need. They form around similarities. The second thing is the implicit assumption is that we all share that concern or need. So we may assume that the thing that brought me to this congregation is also the thing that brought you. But it may not be. But we think it is, right? We share an assumption that we all kind of are here for the same reason. And, of course, some of the things are true. Like, you know, we share a commitment to the Christian faith. Probably all of us do that in a congregation. We often believe that we can accept differences in a group like that, that we can ignore them. And sometimes we can. And sometimes they can be managed, and like I said, in healthier systems where anxiety is low, we can manage our differences better. But in some cases, if the issue is very volatile or very controversial, or if the system itself just doesn't deal very well with difference or anxiety, differences actually trigger more anxiety. So as I was saying, people in my congregation were discovering, wait a minute, I've gone to church with you for 30 years, I never knew you thought that. You know, this is upsetting to me to find this out now after 30 years. So what happens is we've just been talking about awareness of differences in a more anxious system, in a place that has less capacity to deal with it, will generate subgroups. Okay, so as we've been saying, the little different groups. And, you know, actually, a lot of times in congregations that aren't having open conflict necessarily, there's already subgroups. You know, think about your own congregation. There's probably subgroups. So, because awareness of differences, we like to be with people who are like us. That's something that social psychology tells us is actually completely normal, that we want to be with other people like us. That is part of human nature, I'm convinced. It's part of the way we're born. It doesn't mean it's the only way it can be, or that we can't strive to be connected with people who are different. But our sort of default setting, if you will, is to be with people like ourselves. That's part of the way we're made. So that's why awareness of differences starts to feel uncomfortable and starts to generate these subgroups. Now, differences that seem to involve incompatible agendas result in a move towards splitting. So we can handle many times certain kinds of differences. Oh, you root for the Steelers, you know, whatever. I root for, well, I don't know, maybe that's not a good example. But I actually don't root for anyone in professional football, but you know, differences that seem less important, we can manage, okay? That's not a big deal. But differences that seem to involve something that is incompatible start to create this splitting, this move towards splitting. You know, we disagree on this issue that seems really, really important to me, or we have very different values when it comes to politics, you know, whatever. That results in a move towards splitting. You see it everywhere. You watch cable news. You know, people are divided. The whole stations are divided based on perspective, right? Now, these differences, or a significant difference becoming manifest in a group, it can happen both when the group's together and when it's apart. So an example of a difference becoming manifest while the group is together is like a Sunday school meeting, or Sunday school class, or a meeting where all of a sudden differences come to the surface, right? You're in a meeting and all of a sudden people start arguing over something. That's the difference coming to the surface, maybe unexpectedly. An example of a significant difference becoming manifest while the group is scattered is the phone tree after church. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where somebody gets on the phone and starts calling around and saying, oh my gosh, did you hear what so-and-so said? And so then there's a difference that's surfacing, but actually the group is not together. And that's actually in some ways the worst, because whoever's being talked about is not there to represent their point of view. So that's not really a good thing. But those are both ways that this happens in congregations. Now, the progression of conflict and splitting tends to look like this. This is on your handout as well. Difference surfaces. That part's inevitable. That's what I was talking about earlier about, you know, relationships, communities. There's going to be conflict. There's going to be differences. How could it not be that way? Each of us is unique, you know. We're never going to be in a relationship with somebody who's just like us. Exactly. So, difference surfaces. That part's a given. Subgrouping occurs. That part's also a given. That's what social psychology tells us, that when difference occurs in a larger group, subgroups will form. That's just part of the way human beings tend to act. Arguments break out. That part's likely, not necessarily inevitable, but we've all seen it in our communities and organizations. Power struggle increases in intensity, also very common. A couple people said power struggle, authority earlier as things that happen in conflict. And then the last stage is the actual splitting. And that's the part that's dangerous, because that's where people actually no longer are arguing. They're not talking. That's what happened in my congregation. There were actually people that stopped speaking to me after that. I was like, you know, like, how are we going to work this out if we can't even communicate verbally? Now, you can tell when splitting is going to start happening. There are some telltale signs. There's an increase in personalizing the issue. So a particular person or group is the problem. As I was talking earlier, systems theory would tell us that that is not true, but that's what we say. That's what we think. If I could just get rid of this person or this group that's disagreeing with me, that would help me. There's vague assertions. They always do that, or you never do this. That's a sign that we're starting to get, again, into that either-or thinking, where things are just either this way or that way. They're never kind of in the middle. There's no nuance. There's no sort of thinking through all the different things that are happening. There's a strong desire to diagnose the other side and explain their closed-mindedness. Like I said, just watch cable news. You'll see that's on there. There's accumulation of anecdotal evidence of the other side's dishonesty or sneakiness. You know, well, they did this, 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 and this. That shows, you know, that they're doing something wrong. And then there's a desire to foster outrage about the wrongs inflicted on your side and downplay the wrongs your side inflicts. So we convince ourselves that our side, our group, is right, and we've been doing things correctly, and they've been doing this all wrong, and they should be, you know, punished or whatever. So this is what happens. The splitting starts to separate the groups, and there's very little opportunity to bring those back together. And once that starts happening, I think my experience, my research suggests it's very difficult for a congregational leader to bring the sides back together. Once you get to this stage, you're in trouble. In fact, if you look at the handout that the other one that had the grid at the top, you'll see at the bottom there's another diagram there that you often find in congregational leadership literature. This is a kind of a classic model that was introduced, I don't know, two or three decades ago probably. And it shows the levels of conflict there. I'm not going to speak about level zero just yet, but the first level is a problem to solve. This is what we were talking about earlier. We can calmly discuss this problem, and we can work together to find a solution. Second level is disagreement. Okay, there's a little more heat, but we're still able to talk and communicate and maybe work together on a solution. Third, you get to contest. Now, this is where people start being more concerned with winning. It's not to the level of splitting yet, but it's still, we're starting to get into that either-or thinking. My side, whatever you get, I lose, and so I'm concerned with keeping as much of what's mine as I can. And remember on the grid here, we're going up on the red scale, okay? Fight or flight is level four. That's where, as we were talking about before, people are engaged in intense conflict, and what happens is, at least my experience is, people who are the most extreme on each side kind of are the ones that are kind of getting into it, and there's a whole lot of people here in the middle that either don't want to fight or are not sure what they think about the issue. They remain silent oftentimes. They're sometimes completely overlooked because these two, you know, sides are fighting so hard. And then the middle drops out, right? Nobody wants to go to church to fight, just to put it frankly. Nobody wants to be caught up in that kind of stuff. So people who are really not as invested in these extreme positions many times will leave. That's why it's called fight or flight, because people feel like I either have to take a side and get really involved in this contentious thing that's happening, or I just have to get out of here. And that's where, you know, the intensity is pretty high at that point, level four. Level five is intractable situation. This is where we're talking about splitting. Stuff is just extremely difficult at that point. Now, the leadership literature suggests that if you're at level one or two, probably you can handle this with your congregational leadership. This is kind of run-of-the-mill community life stuff. When you get to level three, it's a little more iffy. Levels four and five, it's very difficult for most congregational leaders to deal with this at these levels because we're simply not trained to do it, okay? The senior pastor that I worked with and I were totally in over our heads with this fight that happened in our church. We didn't know what to do. We tried some stuff. It was very ineffective because, frankly, we didn't know how to do this stuff. I think we would have been better served by bringing in someone who knew more about conflict resolution that could help us. Now, there's always a risk to that. Sometimes people feel like this person doesn't know us, we don't want to talk in front of this person, whatever. But the problem in our situation was the congregation was fighting over sexuality, but the vote was about whether or not to stay in our denomination. And the senior pastor and I could not be neutral on that question. We had to say, you know, our ordination is with the UCC. We stay with the UCC. Now, some people experience that as an ultimatum. They were like, oh, you're threatening us. And we were like, no, we're telling you the consequence of your choice. Like, if you guys decide to leave, we can't stay. That's all. But we were not seen as neutral. Okay, so we were not really able to effectively manage this process because people who disagreed with the denomination were saying, well, you're already on that side. You've already decided what we should do. And that wasn't quite true, but it was true that we were more identified with one side of the conflict than the other, just by virtue of our position. So that's just something to help us think through. Okay, if I had to assess the level of conflict in my community right now, where would I put it? And if I can put it at these lower levels, then I might feel confident that our leadership can work with this. If we're at the higher levels, maybe not. Like, maybe this is a sign we need to get some outside help or support, or at least get some training, okay? And my recommendation is to get the training before you have a major conflict erupt in your congregation, all right? Now, many people are always intrigued by level zero, which this graph labels as depression. That's an interesting concept. The level zero, I think, was added later. The person who developed this model first had levels one through five, and then later he added zero. This is trying to describe a group or a community, congregation, where there seems to be no conflict at all. You know, where everything is just very, you know, settled. There's never any disagreements. The person who developed this model said, that's actually not a good thing. Because probably what's happening is people are not being honest. Because in any community, like we've talked about, there's going to be differences of opinion. So sometimes what has happened in this situation, for example, is that a community may have been through a very divisive conflict in the past, and they no longer feel like they have any energy to deal with conflict. So they just don't talk about it. And so that's why he calls it depression, because it's sort of like a community that is doesn't even have the energy to engage. Okay, so you were talking about conflict being energizing. This is a congregation that actually has no energy even to engage regular disagreements. So it's actually a sort of a counterintuitive thing. Like, we think if our community is conflict-free, that's what we want. But I actually don't think that's what we want. I think what we want is healthy conflict, which is where we can do this in a way that does not raise anxiety, where people don't feel the need to get reactive, they don't feel the need to split. So we're going to go there in just a second, but I want to pause here because we have plenty of time left, I think, to do what I had planned for the rest. But I just want to stop and see, are there questions, comments at this point? Yeah.
Theologically, what are some examples? Because when you look at the Bible, it's all conflict. Our Savior, the conflict ended up in death. And splitting. You know what I mean? I mean, it's hard to find the...
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, theologically, are you asking how do you sort of present a theological model for not splitting?
Yeah.
That's a good question, because, frankly, the history of the Christian church is splitting. It's just, you know, this group formed, and then this group split off, and then that group split off, especially for Protestant. That's what we do best.
That's how it spread throughout the world.
Right. I mean, so in some ways, it's an ingrained part of our tradition. I think there's some different ways you could go with that. The way that I have kind of addressed it in my work is really through the body of Christ metaphor, image in Scripture, because my interpretation of that Scripture, that passage, is that, you know, the passage says we all are like different parts of the body. We work together, and the parts are different. They are actually not meant to be the same. You know, the eye can't say to the hand, why aren't you like me? Because then the body would be incomplete if we didn't have all the parts. So my interpretation of that passage is that God didn't actually intend for all of us to be the same. That's not the way we're created. We're actually intended to be very different and to work together with our differences. Now, I don't say that to make it sound like it's just so easy, okay? Because our own bodies don't always work together all that well. You know, especially I find the older I get, the less well certain parts seem to work. But for me, that's a very central metaphor, because it gives us a vision of what the church can be. That it doesn't have to be a group of eyes over here and a group of hands over here and a group of feet. They actually don't get a lot done, you know, if that's what it is. So for me, it's a very powerful, inspiring model of us being able to use our differences constructively to work together. I mean, I think there are certainly others in Scripture that you could find that could be, helpful. I mean, we have examples in Acts, for example, of, you know, the Jerusalem Council and people trying to work out their differences. Like I say, it's not perfect because people aren't perfect. But you're right. I mean, it is difficult in a tradition that has had schisms so much as part of our history. It's hard to think, you know, well, Where is the theological basis for us doing this? But my other thought, too, about that is it's not directly scriptural, but it's related to the history piece. It's, you know, I think we've been done a really good job of the breaking apart. Like, okay, we've done that, you know, for 2,000 years. We've done that. Now, let's try to think a little more about the staying together. You know what I mean? Because right now, I mean, particularly in mainline Protestantism, we need to stay together. We really, you know, have a lot of other challenges that are happening. If we're continuing to break apart, I think it's not going to be very good for us. So really kind of from a practical or ecclesial standpoint, we need to work on that staying together piece, because I think we've tended to think about, well, if we have differences of certain kinds, we just can't stay in fellowship. And, at certain points in history, maybe that was necessary for the different traditions to form or for people to stand on their principles. But I'm just not sure it's going to serve us well going into the future. Is there a hand over here? Any other questions or comments at this point? Yes.
I'm just going to say that it seems like so much of the conflict and splitting happens because instead of concentrating on what we disagree on, we concentrate on that instead of mm-hmm. what we actually all do agree on.
Right.
And that should be the central thing, and it usually does inform the argument that we all
right.
are Christians.
Right.
And we end up not treating each other
mm-hmm.
like Christians,
Right, and that's an interesting point about trying to focus on our commonalities or the unity we have in Christ or in our congregation. And I think that's an important point. The sort of balance to that that I try to articulate in my work is that I think that's really important value, you know, that we are all Christian, that we share this faith tradition, that we're unified in Christ, and that we are different and we have different perspectives, and that's actually a good thing, you know, because I think sometimes we use Christian unity to mean sameness. And when people are not the same as us, then we think, well, we can't be part of the same tradition or congregation. So I try to make a distinction between unity and sameness. And if the desire for sameness is too high in a group, that's often where you get trouble, because then people, you know, we just can't tolerate those differences. And actually, I think that if we were to engage the differences better, we would be more able to keep our identity as a whole group. But what happens, I think, in congregations is we cover over the differences. We don't want to talk about those. And we assume sameness. And then when the difference surfaces, as it will, people get really, you know, bothered, because it's like, wait a minute, I didn't think we were different on that. I mean, I had this experience just the other day. A colleague and I were talking about we're bringing in candidates for a faculty position. And I said, oh, what did you think of this candidate? She's like, oh, I just really didn't like her and all this stuff. And I thought, huh, I had a really different impression of that person. And this colleague and I are really good friends. And it actually kind of made me feel weird inside, because I was like, wait a minute, like, we agree on so much. Like, we're always on the same page on stuff. How could you experience this person so differently than me? You know, and actually we kind of had to think about that. Like, okay, like, I don't have to resolve it. Like, she could not really like the person and I could like them, and that's okay. You know what I mean? Like, that's part of being human. But I actually felt that in my gut. I mean, like, I don't like this feeling, you know, because I really thought we were the same. Yeah.
I just wanted to, this is something we haven't talked about, and that's not the point of your talk anyway, but I was thinking that cognitive development theory and faith development theory.
Yeah. Sure.
Because it helps you understand why it is that people want to be black and white.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
How the move away from that is the developmental process.
Right.
It helps you be more compassionate with the process.
Right, exactly. I do think it has some value in talking about this. Part of what I think the shadow side of it potentially is for people to say, well, you're not as developed as I am, so that's why you're having trouble with this. You're just not as far along on the scale, which may actually be true, right? But I think you're right. It helps us to understand it. But
I think for the people in leadership,
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. How it informs.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. And I do think it helps have empathy. Like, to think about what are the times when I have felt troubled by difference. Like I was just saying, this experience with my friend. That was a good learning for me, because I was like, I think I've been thinking about this so long. I'm like, you know, other people get anxious when the presence of difference, but not me. But, you know, all of a sudden with my friend, I'm like, I don't like this feeling at all. You know, like, I want us to resolve this. I want us to agree on whether the person was good or not, you know. So that's a good reminder to me that under periods of stress or anxiousness, many of us will go back, even if we have maybe developed in a different way to a different place where normally black and white thinking is not what we do. Many times when we're anxious or under stress, we go back to it, which is what I was feeling, I think, because I was feeling kind of anxious about this whole process. But it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I need to reflect on that, and then that helps me to have more empathy. So I think that's good. Well, your mention of leaders is actually a great segue into our last piece here, because as was mentioned before, the role of leadership in this kind of a process, I think, is really crucial. It's not that the leader is the only person who needs to be less anxious. I mean, hopefully there are others out there who are less anxious. But I really think that the move from competition way of thinking to creative collaboration is really dependent in the responses of the congregation's leaders to what's happening in the group. Now, by leaders, I'm not just meaning people with an official title, like the pastor or whatever, although certainly those are leaders. But, you know, every congregation has lots of leaders that may be unnamed, may not have an official position, but yet people look to them, you know, for wisdom and guidance. So how those leaders respond to conflict in the group is really, really important in determining how it comes out. So I think it's very important for leaders in a community to recognize their position in the conflict. So is the conflict about me? You know, are people fighting about something related to me? Or is it something like what I was describing in my congregation before, where there's a conflict over an issue, but I'm clearly identified with one side of it? Or is it a conflict where, you know, it's a disagreement over something and I'm not necessarily identified with either side? I'm sort of seen as a neutral party. It's important to know which of those we're inhabiting, right, because it's going to help us understand the responses of people. Like I was saying, maybe we would have recognized earlier, if we'd been thinking about this, oh, people aren't going to really accept us being the leaders of this process because they think we're already, you know, identified with one side. I think the leaders also have to know or recognize the emotional intensity of the conflict. So it's back to what we were talking about with the model, the levels of conflict, being able to say, okay, is this something I think we can really deal with the resources we have here, or is this something where we need outside support? Our congregation, I feel like, went from 1 to 4 in one meeting. I mean, it really was like that. I mean, or maybe even 0, because the senior pastor and I didn't know anything was wrong until we walked into this meeting and people were just exploding. I was like, oh, okay. So what's been happening is the Sunday school class has been meeting for 4 weeks, you know, getting worked up about this, and we didn't know it. So recognizing what the level of intensity is really important. The need for a planned process, deliberate steps that take time, particularly the more intense the conflict, the more time it's probably going to take. So remember the church I mentioned earlier where they were working on the worship question? They took 4 months to figure that out, all right? Now, like I said, most people thought, well, gosh, why couldn't you have one meeting and just decide which one to get rid of? But they didn't want to do it that way. They felt like that would be much more divisive and harmful to the congregation in the long run. So they, the pastors there recognized we need a process. We need an intentional way of approaching this. The fourth thing is the importance of ground rules or guidelines for the work that needs to be done. So remember earlier I was talking about conflict and contest and how a contest has rules that govern the engagement of the parties. And many times in churches we don't feel we have that. I gave you an example on the back side of this diagram sheet of a behavioral covenant. This is an example of one that was developed by a governing board of a congregation, and you'll see at the bottom, it comes from a book called Behavioral Covenants in Congregations. So it's a whole book that kind of talks to you about how you could develop something like this in your own faith community. Now, the benefit of something like this is to say right out in the front, even before any major conflict has erupted, ideally, to say what are the ways in which we commit to each other to behave. Because frankly, I was shocked by some of the behavior I saw in my congregation. I was amazed at what people were willing to say to each other in church, and not in a good way. I mean, like, you know, really hateful, mean stuff. And so if we had had something like this in place, it would have helped us, I think, at least to be able to say, wait a minute, let's go back to our behavioral covenant. What are the things that we have agreed to do and not do together as a community? Now, that, I'm not saying that would necessarily solve everything, but it would at least give you some kind of a ground rule to say, okay, we agreed, name-calling is not okay, yelling is not okay, like whatever it is, this is what we commit to do. Okay, so for example, on this one, you notice at the very bottom, we promise to support the final decision of the board, whether it reflects our view or not. Okay? So that would be a place where you could go back to somebody and say, you know, so-and-so, I understand you've been going around telling people that you don't like this decision. If you'll be reminded, this is what we agreed to. Now, it doesn't mean the person's behavior necessarily is going to change, but at least you have something to say, look, we all agreed. And I do this with my classes many times in seminary to say, let's decide, what are the ground rules for a discussion with each other? You know, how are we going to handle differences that come up because they're going to? You know, I mean, that's what's going to happen. So this is just one example of a way that you could have some kind of ground rules or guidelines for conversation, which can be very important. And then finally, the key role of a referee or facilitator. Now, in like we were saying, in the less intense levels of conflict, those people could be your congregational leadership, whether it's the pastor or members of the session, if you're Presbyterian, for example, or whomever it might be in your congregation. But if it's a really intense conflict, you may want to consider having someone else do that work for you because it just may not be possible for you to do it effectively. Now, specific suggestions for leaders. The first one that I have is to acknowledge difference and anxiety. So I think there's actually something very powerful in leaders just saying very often and in public spaces before conflict really gets going, there will be differences in our midst. I mean, that sounds so simple and so common sense, but yet people are so bowled over by it when it happens. So just having somebody in leadership or multiple people in leadership, I think ideally, to say differences are part of being in community. Let's talk about how we will handle differences or what kind of differences may exist already in our midst. And also acknowledging anxiety. I mean, I just wonder now what would have happened if in that meeting where I talked about it went from 1 to 4, if one of us could have named, you know, because I felt it as soon as I walked in the room, if I could have just said, you know, I'm just sensing there is a lot of tension in here. People just feel really anxious. I'm wondering what that's about. Now, I'm not saying it would have gone a totally different way, but I think it would have helped maybe diffuse things a bit. So maybe we could have had conversation instead of a shouting match, you know what I mean? Like maybe we could have just kept it down to level 2, maybe, or 3. So just acknowledging those things and naming them sometimes can be very important, because a lot of times people are experiencing it, but they don't have a name for it, or it's almost subconscious. Like, we know something's happening here, but we don't know what it is. The second suggestion I have is cultivating what I call calm, connected leadership. This is language from family systems theory. It talks about the importance of being less anxious. Some of the literature uses the word non-anxious, but I tend to use the phrase less anxious because I feel like it's not really possible to be non-anxious in these situations. But less anxious than the people around you, developing that ability to remain calm and to be not as emotionally reactive in situations, but yet being able to stay connected. That second part is so important. We think about being, you know, individuals, and we want to say our piece and say our opinion, and like that's how we express our individuality. That's great, and I think that's very important to claim a position. But if you do it without being connected, it doesn't work very well. What ends up happening is you just get the splitting, essentially. So if we could find ways to say, this is where I stand, this is my position, and I really want to stay connected with you. So how can we do that? You know, how can we continue to talk, even though we really disagree? That's basically what broke down in my congregation, was people just stopped talking. But the calm, connected leadership idea is interesting, because those in the community who bring a lower level of anxiety, a higher level of personal safety, remember we talked about anxiety being not feeling threatened, but feeling like, you know, I'm safe in this environment, I don't have to defend myself, and at the same time who can stay connected to others, those are actually the people often who become leaders in the church or in a particular conflict. We think of leaders as, you know, people who have positions or who've agreed to certain jobs, but another way of thinking about leadership is when a conflict erupts, think of your own community, who emerges as the person or people who can remain calm and stay connected to other people? Those are your leaders, whether or not they have a title. That's them. And they are the ones that can actually help deal with conflict more effectively. If they can be in the midst of that and not be, you know, sort of swept away in the emotional tide, we might say. And I actually think a big part of the job of leadership in any congregation, whether it's the pastors or other leaders, is to help keep the level of anxiety in the emotional system down. Not spreading it, right? So we talked about how anxiety is like a virus. It can just spread all over the place. There are things that we can do to spread it. There are things we can do to help it stop spreading. So, for example, when somebody comes to you and says, you know, somebody's upset about such and such, you know, we can spread that around and talk about how upset everybody is. That spreads the anxiety. Or we can say, really, you know, who's upset? Well, they don't want me to tell you. That's something I heard all the time as a pastor. I would say, well, you know, I really can't address it if I don't know who it is. But I encourage you to say to this person, whoever he or she may be, to come talk to me about it. And if they don't feel comfortable coming alone, why don't you come with them? And we'll have a conversation. You know, that's a different response than saying, you know, oh, who's upset? You don't have to find out. You know, I mean, there's ways we can be more calm and responsive, still try to address the problem and not ignore it, but we don't have to spread the anxiety. And so then how do leaders help others manage their anxiety? Well, it starts with you. It starts with managing our own anxiety first. I mean, we had the example earlier someone mentioned of if the leader is very anxious and worked up, it's going to just infect everybody. But if the leader can be more calm, less anxious, and be more responsive and less reactive, less defensive, that's hard. Because when we feel threatened or we feel somebody's attacking our integrity, we want to defend, but that's usually not very effective. So if we can manage our own anxiety first, help stay connected with other people who disagree with us, and then help other people stay connected with one another across their differences, that can be really helpful. One thing I say to my students often is, as a leader, you don't want to just tell other people to be calm, right? You want to bring your own calmness to the situation. Telling people to be calm doesn't usually work, because usually it's said like, be calm, you know, calm down. But if you bring your own calmness, it actually can have a spreading effect as well. Just as anxiety can infect, calmness can spread also in a group. If people who are being looked to for leadership are able to, you know, stay in that place and not feel like they're getting infected with the anxiety. Sure.
Mm-hmm. When I was a pup in my life, I had a boss with whom I had a terrible conflict. Mm. Money, and it was a very bad situation. Mm-hmm. And she was angry, and I was embarrassed and angry.
Right.
And so the two of us were like,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Right now, I need to ask you to indulge me. Let's pause, go spend some time in prayer by ourselves, whatever, mm-hmm. and then let's make an appointment to talk about this. We're both feeling less stressed.
Absolutely. That is a terrific solution or suggestion.
Leader's responsibility is also to find a way to acknowledge their own.
Absolutely. And that's something I've been thinking about some lately, too, is I do think the idea of calmness or less anxious is really important. But I don't want that to suggest that leaders don't have feelings or that they don't get, you know, triggered by this stuff. And so as you're saying, if we can find a way to even be emotionally connected, to say, I had a field ed supervisor when I was a seminarian. One of the best things he ever told me was, if you can learn how to say, I'm getting angry. I feel myself getting angry. Instead of waiting until you're really angry and exploding, if you can say it as you're feeling, to say, wait a minute, I feel myself getting angry. I need to take a minute to, you know, think about this or pray or whatever it is so that we can continue this conversation, rather than just waiting until you get to that point where you're going to blow, you know, that is really important. So thank you for that reminder, the importance of also being emotionally aware that we can say, you know, this is what's happening in me. And then the last thing I would suggest is providing all opportunities or opportunities for all voices to be heard, because what usually happens, as I said, in a divisive conflict is very extreme voices get a lot of airtime, and there's this whole group in the middle that you never hear from. And frankly, they don't want to say anything because they don't want to get attacked. You know, they're afraid. And so if you can find ways to have, like, small group process, for example, that was one thing we did not do. We had these big meetings where people just basically yelled at each other, you know, and it was totally ineffective. But if we had a way to have maybe small group process where people could talk in a more intimate setting where they felt comfortable, I think it would have been more effective. But when I say all voices be heard, I'm not saying you should let people be bullies or be bullied. I'm not saying you should let people just say whatever they want and be abusive. I mean, that goes back to the behavioral covenant piece we were talking about. So that's not what I'm trying to suggest. What I'm trying to say is trying to get as many people in the conversation as you can, particularly if it's something that involves the whole community. If you can find a way to listen well to everybody, or as many people as you can, usually people will be more likely to feel comfortable and also be willing to live with the decision that's made. There's good research on this in social psychology. Even people who are receiving a sentence for a crime, if they feel that they have had the opportunity to say their piece or present their side in court, they're willing to accept the sentence. Even if it's not what they would have chosen, they're more willing to accept it because they feel like I was heard. And I heard this over and over again in my research. I felt heard or I didn't feel heard. Okay? So that's very important. As far as specific techniques, we've already talked about behavioral covenants. Another one that I sort of like, particularly when you're talking about trying to make a decision, is the anybody else technique, which is where you're asking people for ideas, or brainstorming, right, or trying to figure out a solution to a problem. And I just keep asking, anybody else, anybody else? And that's supposed to allow people to say ideas, but nobody's allowed to rebut or debate ideas. They're only allowed to name them. Okay? So you get everything out on the table, anybody else, until there's nobody else that wants to say anything. Then you can have conversation about the relative merits of different ideas. But if you let people rebut and debate as you go on, first of all, there's some people that are going to rebut and debate everything, right? But then people feel less inclined to share anything because they don't want to be, you know, basically shot down as soon as they say something. So that's one that's more about kind of decision-making collaboratively. Another one is functional subgrouping, and that's where you have people, when subgroups have formed, okay, which they will, as we talked about, you have people in a group that already agree with each other, talk to one another in a circle. Everybody else sits on the outside and just listens. Again, nobody gets to debate or interrupt. You only listen to what those people are saying to each other about why this position is important to them. Then people on the outside can ask clarifying questions. They can take notes, but it's not a time for arguing or debating. Then the other side, or however many groups you have, another group takes the middle position. They talk to each other about why they believe this one position or they agree with this one position. That's what that church that worked on the worship problem did. They had people from each service sit together and talk about why that service mattered to them, what was meaningful to them about that worship service. All of a sudden, people on the outside were like, I never knew that this was happening in that worship service or that this meant so much to that person. They learned about each other. And that set the stage for them to be able to work collaboratively together to figure out a solution to that problem. So that's something that takes a little bit more maybe skill as a facilitator, but it's not a hard technique to learn. So it's something that you can adapt easily for various kinds of settings. I'm just about out of time, so I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much for your attention, and if you have further questions, I'll stay around for just a few minutes. Thank you.